the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
On today's show, you will hear stories from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. We close our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand with a report about population losses in the rural United States.
The latest U.S. Census, the official counting of the country's people, identified losses in America's rural population. The losses added to an already severe worker shortage in the country's farming and ranching areas. These industries have called for immigration reforms to help with the problem. The census information showed that small population gains in many rural areas were driven by increases in Hispanic and Latino residents. Many of them came as immigrants to work on farms or in meatpacking operations or to start their own businesses. We've struggled on this issue for a long time to try to come up with a more reasonable, common-sense approach, said John Hansen. He is president of the Nebraska Farmers Union, which is a part of a group asking Congress for new immigration laws. Vilifying immigrants just makes it harder to get there, Hansen said. The population changes are clear in Nebraska, where only 24 of the state's 93 counties gained residents. Of those 24, only 8 reported an increase in the white population, suggesting most of the growth was driven by minorities, said David Druzd. He is a researcher with the University of Nebraska Omaha's Center for Public Affairs Research. Druzd examined the census information and found that Nebraska counties with more non-white immigrants are where most of the meatpacking operations are found. In the rural areas, if you didn't have the Latino growth, employers would be struggling even more just to fill those positions, Druzd said. In New Mexico, populations decreased across 20 rural counties because there was a shortage of laborers for the yearly chili harvest. The state promised up to $5 million to increase pay for chili pickers and processors. Pay rates now reach nearly $20 an hour. Some Republican state legislators blame the lack of laborers on unemployment pay, which they say can affect whether a person chooses to work. Democrats see a continuing labor crisis. The New Mexico Chili Association trade group says the industry has a shortage of about 1,350 seasonal laborers. The problem is just as bad for chicken farmers in North Carolina, where meat processors support the economies of many rural communities. Half of the state's 100 counties have lost population since 2010, the census information showed. Bob Ford is executive director of the North Carolina Poultry Federation. He said labor shortages at chicken plants will only worsen as people continue to leave rural communities. Adding to the problem, he said, is the loss of migrant workers going to better-paying jobs in other industries, such as building. Ford said while higher pay for workers and better health care and housing could help, changes to immigration policy would do a lot more to solve the labor shortage problem. The National Pork Producers Council is asking federal lawmakers to change visa programs so that migrant workers can remain employed longer. Bladen County, North Carolina, is home to the world's largest pork processing operation, Smithfield Foods Tar Heel Plant. Between 2010 and 2020, the county's population dropped by 15.9%. Bertie County, which is home to a large Purdue Farms chicken processing operation, saw a population decrease of 15.7%. I'm Susan Shand.
The U.S. government is investigating a series of crashes involving Tesla cars that were using the American automaker's driver assistance systems. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, said this week it had identified 11 crashes involving Tesla models that struck emergency vehicles that were parked on the road. Those accidents resulted in one death and 17 injuries. Three of the 11 crashes took place in California, while others were in Florida, Texas, Massachusetts, and other states. The four latest crashes happened in 2021, including one in July. The NHTSA said it had confirmed that the Tesla cars involved were using either the company's autopilot or traffic-aware cruise control systems just before the crashes. Both systems use a series of cameras and sensors to assist drivers. Tesla says its autopilot system is designed to permit full self-driving capabilities. But the company says when using this tool, drivers should still keep their hands on the steering wheel and be ready to take control if the system fails to work. When turned on, autopilot requires drivers to agree to keep their hands on the steering wheel at all times. The system also includes sensors to identify pressure on the steering wheel and issues warnings if it thinks the driver is not holding the wheel. The company's traffic-aware cruise control is designed to keep the vehicle at similar speeds as surrounding traffic. The NHTSA said most of the accidents took place after dark, but it noted that the parked emergency vehicles used safety measures such as flashing lights, flares, or road markers. The agency said the investigation will cover 765,000 Tesla vehicles. That number includes nearly every vehicle the company has sold in the U.S. since the start of the 2014 model year. The NHTSA announced it had begun its investigation in documents published online. Tesla has not officially commented. Tesla chief Elon Musk has repeatedly defended the autopilot system. In April, he tweeted that Tesla vehicles using autopilot were now approaching 10 times lower chance of accident than an average vehicle. The agency closed an earlier investigation into autopilot in 2017 without taking any action. After its new investigation, the NHTSA could decide again to take no action. Or it could demand a vehicle recall, which could place limits on how, when, and where autopilot operates. In a statement to the French press agency AFP, an NHTSA spokesperson said the agency wants the public to know that no commercially available motor vehicles today are capable of driving themselves. The spokesperson noted that driver assistance programs can improve safety, help drivers avoid accidents, and reduce the severity of crashes. But the spokesperson added that, as with all technologies and equipment on motor vehicles, drivers must use them correctly and responsibly. The National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, has said autopilot was operating in at least 3 deadly Tesla crashes in the U.S. since 2016. It has criticized Tesla's lack of system safeguards for autopilot and NHTSA's failure to take steps to ensure the safety of the system. The chair of the NTSB, Jennifer Homendy, praised the NHTSA's new investigation. She said the board has urged the agency to develop standards for driver assistance systems. It has also called for requirements for automakers to use system safeguards that limit the use of automated vehicle control systems to those conditions for which they were designed. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was the nation's first Secretary of the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton firmly believed that no country could become a modern nation without industry. So he carefully developed a program that would make the United States an industrial nation. Part of his program protected American manufacturers from foreign competition. Hamilton protected them by establishing a system of import taxes on some foreign goods brought into American ports. These tariffs raised the prices of those goods. As a result, American manufacturers had much less competition in selling their products. Alexander Hamilton also organized the nation's finances. One of his first steps was to pay back the debt the country owed from the Revolutionary War. But Hamilton wanted to go much further. He wanted to establish a national bank. Hamilton argued that many European countries had national banks. University of Virginia history professor Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton saw the advantage of Britain's system. It permitted a very small country to go deeply into debt while fighting wars.
The British had essentially been able to project power well beyond their size thanks to a very efficient financial system and system of borrowing.
Hamilton said a national bank in America would increase the flow of money throughout the country. It would help the national government negotiate loans and collect taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says Hamilton believed a centralized bank would also keep the states from competing with each other.
Banks always have the problem is that they're in the money business. And so they're always tempted to lend too much and to speculate too much. And so he wanted the central mechanism to keep them on a short leash.
But Hamilton's plan raised old fears, especially among farmers in the South. Critics argued that a national bank would give too much power to a few rich men in the North. It would take control of state banks on which Southern farmers and small businessmen depended. It would also increase the use of paper money instead of gold and silver. James Madison led the opposition against Hamilton's plan in Congress. Madison said the United States should not put all its wealth in one place. So he proposed a system of many smaller banks in different parts of the country. He also argued that the idea of a central bank was unconstitutional. No one knew more about the American Constitution than James Madison. He was given credit for most of the ideas in it. Everyone respected his explanations of its wording. Madison noted that the Constitution gave Congress a number of powers which were stated. For example, the Constitution gave Congress the power to borrow money. But Congress could borrow money only to repay debts, to defend the country, and to provide for the general good of the people. Madison said permitting Congress to do more than what was in the Constitution was dangerous. Hamilton presented a very different view. His view came to be known as the implied powers doctrine. In other words, the Constitution includes powers without naming them. Business historian John Steele Gordon says this means that Congress can do whatever it needs to do to fulfill its duties unless the Constitution forbids it.
This is an argument that's been going on in the United States now for well over 200 years and probably will go on for another 200 years.
In 1790, Hamilton's view won more congressional support. He got enough votes to approve his proposal to establish a national bank. Still, President George Washington had to sign the bill into law. Washington worried about the possibility that the bill was not constitutional. So he asked three men for advice: Attorney General Edmund Randolph, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, and Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. Randolph had no firm answer. Jefferson agreed with Madison. Creating a national bank violated the Constitution. Hamilton, of course, disagreed. He said the Constitution gave government a number of powers besides those written down. Otherwise, he said, the government could not work. These arguments did not completely answer all of President Washington's questions. but he went ahead and signed the bill to establish a national bank in America. One of its jobs was to maintain the value of the country's currency and to borrow money for the government. The National Bank also increased the flow of capital needed for investment. It fed the country's business and commercial activities, and it collected taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says America's financial success in the 1790s showed that Hamilton's plan worked.
It was known as the Hamiltonian miracle.
The National Bank and many of Hamilton's other ideas had another important effect. They created a disagreement that still exists. The disagreement began with Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. The two men were very different. Alexander Hamilton was born in the West Indies to a man and a woman who were not married. However, Hamilton was educated in America, and he gained a place in society by marrying the daughter of a wealthy landowner in New York State. Money and position were important to Hamilton. He believed men of money and position should govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson could have been what Alexander Hamilton wanted to be. Through his mother, he was distantly related to British noblemen, and he liked fine food, wine, books, and music. But Jefferson had great respect for simple farmers and for the men who opened America's western lands to settlement. He believed they, too, had a right to govern the nation. University of Virginia historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says both Hamilton and Jefferson believed they were defending the ideals of the American Revolution. And, he says, their disagreement revealed their fears. Professor O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton remembered the chaos under the country's first weak government. He was afraid the government would collapse and there would be social anarchy.
John Adams and Alexander Hamilton felt that differences were breaking down too much and that it would lead to a breakdown in authority.
On the other hand, he says, Jefferson and his supporters were afraid that the American Revolution would, like most revolutions, fail. A small elite group would control the country again. In other words, they were afraid of tyranny. Hamilton and Jefferson's personal disagreements turned into a public dispute when they served in President Washington's cabinet. The president tried to make peace between them. He liked them and respected them. He believed the new nation needed the skills of both men. However, the disagreement became more than just a question of two strong men who could not agree. It became a battle of two completely different philosophies of government. Those who supported Hamilton became known as the Federalist Party. The Federalists supported a strong national government with a powerful president and courts. In the early 1790s, the Federalists controlled the Congress. They also had great influence over President Washington. Most Federalists lived in the cities of the Northeast. They were the nation's bankers and big businessmen. They were lawyers, doctors, and clergymen. But at the time, the majority of Americans were farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. Many were bitter over government policies that always seemed to help the wealthy. They had no political party to speak for them. These were the people Thomas Jefferson wanted to reach. Jefferson's task was big. Many of these Americans knew little of what was happening outside their local area. Many were not permitted to vote because they did not own property. Jefferson looked at the situation in each state. Almost everywhere, he found local political groups fighting against state laws that helped the rich. These local groups were what Jefferson needed. He worked to bring them together into a national party to oppose the Federalists. The party came to be called the Jeffersonian Republicans, or just the Republicans. It may sound confusing, but today many of Jefferson's ideas are expressed by the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. This is because of changes in parties and party names over the years. In Jefferson and Hamilton's time, says Professor O'Shaughnessy, the idea of organized political parties was new in America.
Today we would regard the existence of party politics as essential for the functioning of democracy. There needs to be a minority view expressed. Government needs to be held accountable by an opposing party.
But at that time, he says, the people who fought in the American Revolution expected to be united. As a result, the country did not have any laws governing what political parties could or could not do. There were no restrictions on the political activities of government officials. So Hamilton and Jefferson carried on a war of words in their party newspapers. Jefferson especially felt the need for newspapers in a democracy. He believed they provided the only way for a large population to know the truth. He once said, if he had to choose between a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he would choose newspapers without a government. Both parties' newspapers carried unsigned articles attacking the opposition. Both printed stories that were false. At times, the attacks were personal. Many people felt the two cabinet secretaries should be above that kind of public fighting. But Professor O'Shaughnessy says that did not stop them.
The party politics became as bad as at any time in history.
Toward the end of President Washington's first administration, he received a letter from Jefferson. The Secretary of State said he planned to resign. He said he disagreed with most of the administration's domestic and foreign policies. He did not name Hamilton. It was not necessary. Washington knew what he meant. Hamilton was the chief planner of those policies. But Jefferson decided not to resign. In a letter to his daughter, Jefferson said the attacks on him changed a decision which he did not think could possibly be changed. He must remain and fight. So while continuing to serve as Secretary of State, Jefferson began working to get his supporters elected to Congress. He believed that was the only way to fight Hamilton. National elections were set for 1792.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.